It's Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. One of the buzzwords when it comes to the economy is uncertainty. Politicians blame slow economic growth on uncertainty over future tax rates or incoming revenue. Businesses decide to hold off on hiring because of uncertainty.
All of that leads to a lot of uncertainty for people in middle and lower classes of wage earners. Uncertainty over paying the rent, buying food, affording college.
Well, Rachel Schneider wanted to learn how American families are withstanding these economic times. And she and some fellow researchers set out to study families over the course of time to get some data and some insight.
The result was the new book, The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. Schneider, who is co-author of the book, joined us on the line recently. Welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm so glad to do it. Thanks for having me.
So what was lacking in our understanding of how families are getting by in the 21st century that you were trying to learn by setting up this Financial Diaries project?
Well, the main thing is we have so much data in the U.S., but most of it is aggregate numbers or averages or snapshots in time. And so those big picture statistics miss a lot about the day-to-day lived experience of real people. And so we wanted to get underneath those numbers to talk to real people and understand what their perception of their financial life was and understand how their finances evolved over a year.
It's interesting. So often we hear about, you know, wanting to add data to anecdotal evidence. In some ways, it sounds like you wanted to add anecdotal evidence to data.
We did. We did, although it's more than anecdotal evidence because we gathered financial data from 235 families for a full year, right? Every dollar that came in and out of their house. So it's both the anecdotal, it's the understanding the person, but it's also the seeing how money moves through time through a family's life rather than getting that snapshot of how much they have in their wallet today.
Well, why was it so important to do it in that way? I mean, give us a sense of your methodology and the kinds of families that you included.
Sure. So we had families in four different locations in the U.S. They were in Mississippi, California, along the Ohio-Kentucky border, and New York. And they really varied a lot, right? If you just think about those locations, their experiences were so different. In New York, it was urban, really densely populated areas, right? Whereas in Mississippi, you're working with a rural population. California, we were more in the suburbs. So some of it was about like understanding the different versions of an American life. What all of the families had in common was that they had somebody in the household who was working, and they were all within the income range of between the poverty level and, let's call it, like roughly around area median income, sort of a middle class, roughly a middle class income. So they were all lower middle class working households. And what we did is we had 10 field researchers who were in each of the locations, and they went and met with families in person. And so we call it the Financial Diaries, but it's not really that we gave people diaries to fill out. It's that a person went and met with them and gathered data from them. And that gave us this really amazing opportunity to ask lots of why questions, right? Like, why are you managing your financial life this way? Or why was there a huge income spike last month? Or, you know, how are you thinking about this particular thing? And that was really powerful. And because we were doing it for a year, we were able to develop real trust with the families who stuck it out. This was a big investment for them. And so for the most part, they were sticking it out because they wanted to share their story and they wanted to have this ongoing relationship with the field researcher. And that's really the power of it. That's what allows us to get below the, you know, underneath the aggregate numbers we usually understand our economy through.
You mentioned the concept of the income spike, and that's, you know, one of the trends that repeats itself throughout the book is this idea of income volatility. And I think maybe a lot of us in the media or maybe throughout society have this image of the different levels of income, but maybe a general thought that people's paychecks look the same from month to month. But you write that's very much not the case for many people.
No, it's really not. I mean, one of the most memorable moments for me of the study was early on when we were just formulating the research plan and figuring out where to do the research and how it worked. And so we were having really broad conversations with families. And I sat in a room with one family, and we didn't even end up writing about this in the book, but this is just a moment that stuck with me. And I said, you know, what's going on with your financial life? And this woman said, and she worked at the checkout counter at the grocery store, and her husband had a job in a warehouse. And she said, basically, you know, it's all about Sunday nights. On Sunday nights, we sit down. By then, we've each gotten our schedule for the week. We know how many hours we're going to be given to work. But they both had full-time jobs. But in a lot of places of employment now, even if you have a full-time job, the number of hours you get each week flexes up and down. So over half of Americans work hourly jobs. So she said, you know, I know if I've gotten 33 hours or 28 or 40 or 42. I know if my husband, my husband knows the same. And they sit down and they estimate what their paychecks will bring them. And then they pull out all their bills and they estimate which bills they can pay with that money. You know, hearing that really changes how you think about budgeting. We want to think people can set a budget, set a monthly expenditure expectation, and then stick to it. And the whole only thing you've got to do is help people develop discipline to stick to their goals. But the reality is a lot more complicated for people. The math is more complicated. The variation introduces all kinds of opportunities for mishap. And that's really what we saw throughout our sample, was that people had very big swings between their high paychecks and their low paychecks. And while some of that was seasonable and predictable, it didn't mean it was always manageable.
Right. You write about one of the people that stuck with me is the woman in Mississippi who works as a dealer at a casino, and she relies a lot on tips. And it's interesting that it fluctuates from year to year based on what the college football schedule is like there.
I know. I never would have thought to ask that, frankly, because I'm not a football person, right? I mean, it's just outside of my scope of experience in a way. But yeah, she works this is Janice, and she's in Mississippi dealing blackjack. And she likes a lot about the job. It's got reasonable benefits. It's been a decent job for her. But yeah, when football games are played away, there's less traffic into the casino, or when they and so the college football schedule really affects her earnings.
She's an African-American woman, and I think you write that that race and other demographics are also wrapped up in the income volatility equation.
They are. So, you know, lower income, lower wage jobs are more likely to also be volatile, and lower income, lower wage jobs are also disproportionately held by people of color, and also disproportionately by women. So a lot of what we're seeing, the effects of it aren't equally distributed across our society. And it led us to think a lot about the idea of inequality. You know, we've been long focused on income inequality as a country, and increasingly so lately. We've focused a lot on wealth inequality. But there is this third piece where people have unequal access to steadiness, unequal access to stability. And stability is a distinct and separate goal for people. Aside from having enough income, people also want to have a stable financial life. And you can help people get that by giving them more money. But even at lower income levels, stability matters.
You know, we mentioned this outdated idea that paychecks are always the same from month to month. As you got into learning how people live, what were some of the other outdated mentalities, at least in some cases, that you find have an impact on how people earn and live?
Probably the biggest thing is the conventional wisdom about how a financial life evolves over the life cycle. Right? So the image we all have in our head, and that was really true for a lot of people in the 50s and 60s, although, to be clear, not true for everyone, was this idea of a life cycle arc. You can even picture this upward trending curve where you would, you know, get an education, go get a job, gradually make more money as you get promoted and have more seniority and have more responsibility, and you gradually earn more. And then, you know, somewhere in that cycle, you'd get married or have kids, you'd start investing for their education, you'd put money away from retirement. And then at the end, you'd retire and you'd earn less money, so the curve would slope down, but you'd have put away enough or invested in a house that rose in value, and so you'd be able to have a secure retirement. And this idea of the life cycle arc is a really important idea in personal finance, a really important idea in how we allocate tax subsidies, right? So we spend $400 billion a year helping people to save for later, because we expect them to live on that arc. Yet, what we saw is that a lot of people, they're not living on an upward trending smooth curve. They're living on a constantly up and down but flat line, where they're not going to earn a lot more 10 years from now than they earn today. And in the meantime, they have such big swings in their month-to-month income that they're not really thinking as much about how to save for retirement or for buying a house as they are thinking about how to save for 3 months from now when my income's going to dip seasonally, or how to put aside enough money so that if my car breaks down in 6 months, I can pay for it. And so a lot of what we came away from this work thinking about is how important sort of near-term financial planning is and how lacking our society really is in providing the help people need for those nearer-term objectives. So, right, that $400 billion we spend on subsidies for savings, that's all for retirement, homeownership, and education. We don't spend any money in tax subsidies to help people save for emergencies or for the natural ups and downs in their financial life. And similarly, we haven't innovated the financial products that would help people to accomplish those goals as much as we have thought about like portfolio diversification. It opens up some new thinking about solutions.
Right. And you're right that there are some people out there that have created some tools that can kind of, you know, smooth the playing field for them, if you will, help people go, you know, survive the peaks and valleys.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of it is about employer practices, right? So you're seeing some innovation around like giving workers more control over their own schedules or more guarantees of predictability. And some of that has to come from policy change too. But there is also some hope in the development of financial services or tweaks to existing financial services that make it easier for people to manage the volatility that they're experiencing. So we write, for example, about one company called Even, which is a pretty new company. And what they do is they try and smooth out those ups and downs in people's paychecks. And they when you sign up with them, they start monitoring your paychecks and they calculate what your average paycheck is. And then when it's low, they boost you up to average, and when it's high, they pay back that boost. And when it's high, they ask, do you want to save extra of this high paycheck? And that service, that idea of like, how do we help you smooth it out, is a very different frame than saying, how do we lend you money or how do we help you save? They're really trying to sell the concept of stability.
So obviously, as you say, there are implications for policymakers or would-be policymakers, for the financial services industry, for innovators. But what was the takeaway from this work for the families that agreed to be a part of this project? When you got to the end of the year, what were the things that you were hearing from them as they had the microscope turned on them?
You know, that was really a place where I learned a ton. So we met all the households initially through local community-based organizations. That's how we got our first entry into the communities we worked in. And the question we got at the beginning from all of them was, what advice are you going to give the households at the end? You know, you're going to gather this information. How are you going to help the families? And so we, throughout the study, thought that at the end of the study, we would then offer resources or advice or connect the families back to other organizations or advisors who could help them with their financial lives. But by the time we got to the end, when we asked the field researchers if they thought this would be a good idea, they said no, terrible idea. And the reason why is that what we saw from the families was an incredible amount of resourcefulness and creativity and personal agency. So even though like what we saw were very challenging circumstances, and they also really were doing the best they could. and didn't want to be treated as though they were failing. You know, our research had been set up to learn from them. And if we then came and offered advice, all of a sudden it's us saying, well, what we learned is that you're screwing up. When really a lot of what we learned was, hey, you're doing this interesting creative thing to make your financial life work. It's not as easy as it could be. And so it really became more about how do we, and it always was from our perspective, how do we share what families are doing to inspire other good solutions that could help them? The families themselves are, you know, they're making it work in all sorts of ways. And that's pretty inspiring.
Well, and I wonder if for the families that were involved in this project, there's a certain comfort in knowing that they're not alone here.
Definitely. Yeah. You know, I think that's true for everyone. Like, financial problems bring so much shame. And we heard this from families as they described when they had trouble, right? People don't talk about their financial problems. They don't talk about having had to declare bankruptcy or getting being unable to pay their credit card debt or not knowing how they'll make their car payment. All of those moments bring shame and anxiety. And I do think we need to change that as a society. We need to be able to talk about financial problems so that people understand they're not alone. It's not all their fault. They're doing the best they can amidst flawed circumstances. And if they feel less shame, they can reach out for help in different ways.
Well, Rachel Schneider, it's important work. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the chance to talk about it.
Rachel Schneider is Senior Vice President at the Center for Financial Services Innovation. She's the co-author, along with Jonathan Mordick, of The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. You will find a link to more about their project at WUWM.com.